today on Edinburgh Radio News.
47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation.
We remember a historic speech made 70 years ago today. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to Edinburgh Radio News for Tuesday, November 19th, 2013. I'm Ana Yukar. The man suspected of carrying out the deadly shooting at LAX earlier this month is in federal custody today. 23-year-old Paul Anthony Ciancia is suspected of killing a Transportation Security Administration officer and wounding two others after opening fire inside the airport on November 1st. Ciancia was shot by the police during the incident and has been recovering in the Ronald Reagan UCLA Medical Center. He was released from the hospital yesterday. No court appearances have been scheduled for Ciancia yet, but federal prosecutors have charged him with murder. The tough economic atmosphere has made hard choices commonplace for employers who often cut services to make ends meet, only to face anger and resentment from workers. As Andy Vasoyan reports, the University of California system is once again the subject of a wave of disapproval.
UC hospital workers who planned to strike got their final okay today when a Sacramento court threw out the UC's attempt to legally block their strike. Representatives for the organizers say that although the university system attempted to stifle the strike, they will still be seeking to work with the nation's largest public school to broker a deal.
We care about the University of California as a whole, as a system, as a provider for this great state, and we want to see it continue to achieve great things and continue to expand and, you know, be affordable for our students and for our patients. But with the things that have been going on lately, you know, by UC management, they're making that very hard to do.
The strike, which is the second in 5 months, will take place tomorrow at the 10 campuses and 5 medical centers that make up the University of California's health system. Andy Vasoyan, Edinburgh Radio News.
After weeks of negotiations, J.P. Morgan has agreed to pay billions of dollars to homeowners, teachers, and California public employees. Emmanuel Martinez reports.
$13 billion. That's the amount J.P. Morgan and the U.S. Justice Department settled on to resolve the company's faulty mortgage investment allegations. This is the largest penalty levied against a single U.S. company. A portion of that money will benefit California. California Attorney General Kamala Harris says nearly $300 million of the settlement will go to the state to resolve allegations involving mortgage-backed securities that were sold to public employee and teacher pension funds between 2004 and 2009. Both California state teachers and public employees' retirement systems will be reimbursed through the settlement. About $400 million of the money will help homeowners facing foreclosure, and nearly $600 million going toward families affected by Hurricane Sandy. The financial giant will also have to pay a $2 billion fine to the Justice Department. The settlement not only means that J.P. Morgan will have to shell out billions of dollars, but the company must also admit that it made false representations to investors and had prior knowledge about the faulty loans. Emmanuel Martinez, Edinburgh Radio News.
It's the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address, when Abraham Lincoln delivered one of the most famous speeches in American history. He proclaimed the need for human equality and unity. The Edinburgh Radio staff banded together to show that Lincoln's message hasn't been forgotten. We bring you the Gettysburg Address.
47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation.
Conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
Now, we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure.
We are met on a great battlefield of that war.
We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live.
It is altogether fitting and proper that we do this.
But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground.
The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract.
The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but can never forget what they did here.
It is for us, the living, rather to be dedicated here, to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced.
It is rather for us to be here, dedicated to the great task remaining before us.
That, from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to the cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion.
That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain.
That this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom.
And that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
In addition to the anniversary of the Gettysburg Address, this week will also mark the 50th anniversary of President John F. Kennedy's assassination. The two famous presidents lived and died a century apart, but as Asal Asani Poor and Sarah Zahedi discovered, they both had a lasting effect on civil rights.
Both Abraham Lincoln and John F. Kennedy are credited with advancing civil rights throughout their presidencies. And now, each is drenched in America's communal consciousness as cherished political icons.
But what's the true extent of the legacy that Presidents Lincoln and Kennedy had on civil rights? JFK experts say their stories are more interlaced than you may think.
Certainly Mrs. Kennedy wanted to link the two legacies of the presidents together, and the issue of civil rights would be the glue that held them together.
That's Andrew Bell, senior historian at the University of Virginia's Center of Politics. He was the senior researcher on the Kennedy Half Century, which was released in October. He says following Kennedy's assassination, the First Lady modeled her husband's funeral after Lincoln's in 1865. Richard Reeves, senior lecturer at University of Southern California and author of several books about Kennedy, says both faced difficult realities even during their presidencies.
The convergence of Lincoln and Kennedy over 100 years on civil rights had one simple axis. That is that they both had to deal with a problem they didn't want to deal with.
Of course, Lincoln's problems were the first and only civil war in American history and the abolition of slavery. Later, Kennedy had to grapple with the growing demands for racial equality while appeasing white Southerners in Congress. Scholars say he didn't show a full commitment to civil rights until after the Birmingham riots of 1963. We'll never know how much progress JFK would have made in the civil rights movement had he not been assassinated. As JFK's successor, Lyndon B. Johnson picked up the mantle of civil rights until the Civil Rights Act of 1965 was passed. Regardless, political analyst Earl Afari Hutchinson says both Clinton and Kennedy deserve the recognition they've deserved.
These individuals, whatever their motivations may have been, Lincoln and Kennedy, the fact is they became ultimately in history identified with civil rights.
Historians and political analysts continue to debate both Lincoln and Kennedy's influence on civil rights movements in the U.S.
But what is clear is that both paved the way for dramatic changes in American society. Asal Asanipour
and Sarah Zahedi, Annenberg Radio News.
The LA Auto Show isn't just about cars anymore. Madeline Newell's reports about the technological advances in the auto industry.
The show began this morning with a Connected Car Expo, a one-day conference and 3 days showcase that features automotive and technology companies who are exploring and developing the future of the connected car space. A connected car space between drivers and their vehicle basically means connecting your smartphone and your car. Walter Faller, the VP of M2M Communications for Sprint, says that big data is the next big thing.
That's going to change the way you drive behind the wheel. It's going to change the way you think about a trip from point A to point B, in that the car will know its own status. You will have your status available through your phone or even as part of a profile that's connected to the vehicle.
Faller also says that marketers will be able to promote deals to consumers through these apps, depending on your information, like deals on oil changes and car washes. Airbiquity is a company that creates a smooth connection between the smartphone and the car with cloud computing. Ben Smith, a marketing specialist for the company, talks about these trends.
So what we've done is we've enabled customers to use their smartphone to upgrade everything seamlessly. So when they want to get that new functionality, they upgrade their app on their smartphone like they would if they were using it just walking around or at home. And the car is going to automatically see the upgrade, the extra functionality.
Many other companies were offering similar services at today's event. Cars such as the Chevy Spark and Sonic already have connected car space capabilities, but automotive companies are continuing to pair with technology businesses to improve and further customize the way their vehicles connect with drivers. Madeline Uhls, Annenberg Radio News.
George Zimmerman is back in court today. The shooter of Trayvon Martin was arrested yesterday after a dispute at his girlfriend's home. He's charged with two misdemeanors and felony aggravated assault, allegedly breaking his girlfriend's table and threatening her with a shotgun. Zimmerman has posted bail to the tune of $9,000. He's banned from possessing guns or ammunition and is prohibited from leaving Florida. Keep a sweater handy, Angelinos, because the weather today is staying chilly. Lows are in the mid-50s for tonight with a high of barely 70 tomorrow and possible showers on Thursday. Later on Annenberg Radio News, one Filipino veteran continues his fight from World War II. The Oxford Dictionary has named selfie as the word of the year for 2013, thanks to a 17,000% increase in the world's usage of the past year. Martha Daniel has more.
We've come a long way since the early days of portrait photography. What was once an exclusive and time-consuming practice has reached the masses in staggering numbers, with 57 million Instagram uploads to date, marked by a selfie hashtag. The Oxford Dictionary defines a selfie as, quote, a photograph that one has taken of oneself, especially one taken with a smartphone or webcam and uploaded to a social media website, end quote. USC linguistics professor Edward Finnegan thinks the Oxford Dictionary made the right decision in choosing the word as word of the year.
It's a brilliant word because it, in the context in which it's used, it's transparent.
The word first appeared on an Australian online forum in 2002 when a man posted about falling while drunk and splitting his lip. He posted a picture with the story, apologizing for it being out of focus as it was, quote, a selfie, and thus the word was born. Selfie culture is a byproduct of the social media boom. Sites and apps like Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Tumblr, and Snapchat have given selfie enthusiasts the platform to publish their photos. Many are labeled as narcissistic. USC freshman Lena Melillo thinks this opinion stems from general disdain toward teenage girls who dominate the culture.
The reason why selfies are really important, especially for preteen and teen girls, is that it's really the first time women ever have gotten the opportunity to show themselves to like a wide audience without it being dominated by the male gaze. And I think that's good for their self-esteem and their body image.
Do you post selfies?
All the time, every day.
Most smartphones are built around the selfie, with front-facing cameras for the user to document what they're doing, how they're feeling, and where they are at any given time. Professional portrait photographer David Zentz thinks that new photography technology has changed the professional landscape.
You know, the notion that anybody can take a decent picture has definitely cheapened what people's perception of photography is. I think overall has made it harder for professional photographers.
And one last question. Do you take selfies?
Rarely, but I suppose I have taken a couple in the past, yes.
Selfie beat out words like twerk and binge watch to win its spot as word of the year. Martha Daniel, Annenberg Radio News.
Tomorrow is GIS Day, Geographic Information Systems. USC professor Dr. Darren Riddell and his students are scheduled to launch a mapping balloon in honor of the worldwide annual celebration. He joined us in the studio earlier today to tell us about what makes this balloon so special.
A balloon can be extremely helpful in capturing aerial imagery. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to do the balloon. A GoPro camera will be attached to it, and it's going to be set at a time lapse of 2-second intervals. So every 2 seconds, it's capturing an image. we're going to send it up on campus and capture, you know, imagery of the campus. And so this is extremely helpful in terms of getting, you know, immediate data on a survey area. And so this was conducted in the Gulf Coast right after the BP oil spill, and it's been a great survey tool. Having, you know, immediate imagery of an area to develop a response plan can be extremely helpful.
And so since there hasn't been a disaster here, what exactly would be using that information
yeah.
for?
Yeah, well, it's also a proof of concept. You know, in case there is a disaster, you know, we have the skills and the expertise to go out and to implement that right away.
Who built this balloon? How was it built? Give us mm-hmm. all the details.
This balloon, we ordered this balloon, you know, online. It's from a public lab. And so public lab is basically a citizen science group. You know, we got it online. It's, you know, maybe $100, you know, and so anyone can do it.
The size. Tell us about the size.
So it's a weather balloon that's used for capturing atmospheric data. And so we send it up. And, you know, the balloons can actually go a pretty high elevation. We're going to fill it up with helium. Mm-hmm. And at maximum capacity, it gets to, you know, around 10 feet in diameter. And so it's actually a pretty big balloon.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of cool. So we send it up. We have a little instrument that the GoPro camera attaches to. And then, you know, we'll send it up, capture the imagery, bring it back down. And then we can download and process that data, you know, real time, just right away.
So how high is the balloon going to go?
It'll probably be around, you know, 400, 500 feet.
Oh, wow. Are there any unusual circumstances that you guys are anticipating, like maybe a bird flying into anything like that?
Birds can fly into it. One time we sent it up and, you know, I was out with my students. I was like, all right, let's stay away from this building. Next thing you know, there's a big gust storm. It smashed the balloon into the building, but the balloon didn't pop. So we were happy about that.
That was Dr. Darren Riddell talking to us about the launch of the mapping balloon over USC's campus. It happens tomorrow at 1 p.m. in Alumni Park, and those who can't make it to the event can follow the balloon's progress on Twitter using the hashtag USCGISDay. Today marks International Men's Day, celebrating the equality of men's rights and bringing awareness about domestic issues men face every day. Amen OU Bouquet reports on one little known problem that some men face.
When people think of domestic abuse, an image of a female victim comes to mind. But what about the male counterparts? Today, in a small conference room, the LA County Domestic Violence Council had a panel of three experts that discussed just that. Panelist Stanley Green of the Men's Health Network believes that the image of domestic abuse starts with what society portrays.
When you look at materials that are outreach for, say, a large government agency or a big corporation to hire, or a university recruiting students, the images they have are not always all of just a few people who look exactly alike. We don't very often see that kind of inclusive graphics when it comes to outreach on domestic violence issues.
A study from the Center of Disease Control and Prevention reported in 2010 that 40% of domestic abuse cases deal with men. Vice President for the National Coalition of Men, Mark Angelucci, says misconception causes men from reporting abuse.
I think the biggest misconception, since they're stronger, they can't really be victimized. And that's simply not true for many reasons. There are many disabled men. There are plenty of same-sex relationships. There are women who are very strong and involved in sports. And a lot of men don't want to hit back.
Panel attendee Fred McCall Sourceful thinks that driving awareness about male abuse should start on college campuses.
One of the barriers that we face is that in colleges, there are virtually no services for men. When you go to a college and you look for service for female students, there are plenty of resources, but in every college, there are virtually none for men.
Little to no research has been done in the area about domestic abuse against males, but today's panelists hope that this discussion will spark more attention for abuse. Amen Oyiboke, Annenberg Radio News.
Changes in the design of a terminal at the Port of Los Angeles have bumped up the budget significantly. Today, the City Council signed off on a bigger budget with some misgivings. Karen Lynn has details.
The price tag for the Port of LA's terminal upgrade escalated to $510 million. It is almost double from the $245 million the City Council authorized 4 years ago. Port officials say the increased budget stems from the new container terminal system called TrayPack It will help the Port of LA become the second partially automated terminal in the nation.
It's an efficiency and competitive issue, and but the whole goal is for this private company, TraPac, to be able to move more cargo through the Port of Los Angeles.
That is Philippe Stanfield, Director of Media Relations for the Port. The City Council approved the budget, but Council Member Joe Buscaino is concerned. The port is in his council district. His legislative deputy, John Larson, says the port didn't consult with the Harbor Commission or City Council before they filed the proposal.
That's where the councilman has concerns, not only just in terms of the project going extremely over budget, but just the fact that we're just finding out about it so late in the process where it's too late to back down now.
Stanfield admits there was miscommunication.
It was a mistake by the port that was acknowledged today in City Council.
But Stanfield says the new terminal is worth the investment.
Over the course of the lease with this company, the port is going to receive about $2.3 billion in revenue. So we will be receiving basically a return on investment of a little under 9%, 8.75%.
Councilman Buscaino has urged the interim director of the port, Gary Moore, to report in 90 days to figure out the reason behind the higher budget and how to prevent the same things from happening again. The upgrade project is scheduled to be completed in 2018. The Port of LA is one of the largest and busiest ports in the nation, handling more than 8 million containers each year. Currently, Annenberg Radio News.
The 90s are back, at least for a while. Reporter Kay Engram caught up with the woman behind the voice of one of our favorite childhood shows.
I don't even know how long it's been since I've actually said this line, but I'll give it a go. Okay.
Move it, football head. Arnold! You may recognize her as the voice of Helga G. Pataki from the 90s hit show Hey Arnold. But she's no longer in the world of cartoons. She's now in the classroom.
I sort of slowed things down with the acting a little bit to go to college. I did my undergraduate in linguistics at Stanford. I did a master's program at Pepperdine University, and then I came here to USC in 2009. I've been working on my PhD here ever since.
Although being a child star can be the biggest mistake for some, Francesca Marie Smith, with the support of her older brother and parents, was able to make it work. After moving from Oregon to Los Angeles at the wee age of 5, Francesca eventually met with the writers and cast of Nickelodeon's Hey Arnold, colleagues she would one day call family.
I was incredibly lucky in that I got to work on some of the neatest shows with some of the neatest people that I could imagine.
During our interview, it was clear that Francesca's relationship with Helga began right from the start.
I would say that the character probably grew up with me in a lot of ways, right? And so as the creative team sort of discovered what her personality was going
to
be like.
Why would Arnold want to talk to her anyway? I mean, she's not exactly a rocket scientist. On top of that, she's a bully. Plus, she's big and ugly.
Helga?
Hey, I'm just making an observation.
That, I think, was probably influenced by, you know, me and what they knew of me and how I was growing and all that kind of stuff.
Smith toils with the idea of going back into acting every now and again, but knows so much about the industry has changed.
I still toy with the idea of what a full-time career in the industry would be like at my age, and I certainly haven't ruled out the possibility of going back to it full-time. And, you know, I'll say I'm a little bit reticent because I'm worried it's never going to be as good as it was.
A common feeling among the 90s generation, who often recount shows like Hey Arnold, yearning to bring those good old days back.
There is something uniquely nostalgic about the 90s cartoon experience that's really blossoming right now and has been probably for the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years or something.
Today, Francesca spends her time researching new media platforms, both as a Google Glass Explorer and a doctoral candidate at USC. Kay Engram, Annenberg Radio News.
Sonic City!
My name is Billy Merritt. I'm an instructor here at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. It's a comedy venue that has improv, sketch, and stand-up. We also have a school, and we have a lot of students work up their way up and do shows here as well.
Your suggestion is wagon.
I always teach on two sides, the analytical and the impulsive side, the left side of your brain, the right side of your brain. The analytical, anybody can learn. The impulsiveness, I think you can learn over time. It's like attack a scene like a pirate, analyze a scene like a robot, get off stage like a ninja.
Sonic City!
In response to Typhoon Haiyan, Councilman Mitch O'Farrell introduced a resolution at the LA City Council this morning to support the temporary protected status for Filipino nationals living in the U.S. Filipinos are the largest Asian population in California, but as Denise Guerra reports, the U.S.-Filipino relationship has often been marred by political and cultural tensions.
Whether it's in a small apartment in downtown Los Angeles or growing up in the Philippines, Franco Arcibal has a knack for adapting to his environments. At 89 years old, he's consistently checking his Gmail for new updates from his family or to send weekly newsletters to his church group. But most of all, his inbox is filled with research and correspondence from legislatures and community organizations on an issue Arcibal has spent the past 20 years fighting for: the recognition that Filipino veterans were active American soldiers in World War II.
We guerrillas were loyal to the American flag. We became loyal and we waited for MacArthur to come. We tried to listen to radio news about the war. You know, the war started December 1941. 1944, only 3 years, 4 years, it's passed. That is not a long time. But for us in the Philippines, it was a very long period waiting. It was terrible, very horrible experience. But because when the war broke out, I was only 18 years old. From grade one to high school, we learned about America, we learned about the geography, we learned how to speak English, we learned history. Did you know that after high school, I knew the history of the United States better than the history of the Philippines? So the loyalty of the Filipinos were kept because of the educational program of
the
United States.
After the Spanish-American War, the Philippines became a commonwealth of the United States. But it was World War II that brought the Americans and Filipinos together on the battlefield against a common enemy, the Japanese.
When MacArthur rallied, he had a rallying speech. You know, his rallying speech was very moving.
People of the Philippines, I have returned. By the grace of Almighty God, our forces stand again on Philippine soil. Soil consecrated in the blood of our two people.
The U.S. Armed Forces employed Arcibal to provide them with the intelligence and locations of the enemy, and it was on his way back to the province of Bayongbong that he was caught and tortured.
And in my case, they asked me to sit down like this.
Arcibal sits, mimicking his hands tied behind his back.
They put the tobacco with amber and put it on my, you see this one?
Arcibal points out dark spots on his arms.
These are tobacco. They burn it like this. They burn. While they are asking questions, they are burning. And that is not enough. They rub salt on it.
It was these memories that gave Arcibal the strength to fight another battle later on in life. After the war ended, President Truman enacted the Rescission Act of 1946. That meant Filipinos who fought side by side with Americans under the territorial flag of the United States would not receive veteran benefits. When Arcibal came to America in the 80s, he was not eligible to be seen at a VA hospital. But Arcibal was a pragmatist and knew that to get the benefits the Filipinos deserve would mean a long fight, but there were smaller wins along the way. With his help, Filipino vets were able to become citizens, petition family members to become citizens, and receive Social Security benefits. But even as Arcibal approaches 90, he continues to battle, one email at a time. Denise Guerra, Annenberg Radio News.
We had help today from Victor Figueroa, Graham Clark produces the Arts and Culture segment, and Denise Guerra is the newscast producer. Our executive producer is Catherine Davis, and for all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Anna Yukar.